Hello and welcome to this week's Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from Revenue Rocket World Headquarters in Bloomington, Minnesota. As you know, Revenue Rocket is the world's premier growth strategy and M&A advisory to IT services firms. We are here today with my partners, Ryan Barnett and Matt Lockhart, to talk about M&A deal financing. Welcome, guys.
Good to be with you, Mike. As you say, we're in our world headquarters, our snowy world headquarters. So it's good to be with you. Good to be inside, staying warm, and excited for the new season.
Totally agree. And great topic today here, Mike. When you think about financing a deal, there's quite a few options. And there's pluses, minuses along the way. So today, I really want to dig into a few different options that buyers may have, and then the impact the seller may have when they're considering the mode of funding that a buyer goes with. So, Mike, in general, to talk about, I think we'll talk about a few things, perhaps seller notes, cash on hand, equity, traditional banking options, and in general. So when a company... Yeah, when you're looking to do an acquisition, there's all sorts of leverage you can pull. And perhaps, Mike, let's start with overall, how should a firm start thinking about what options that they have in front of them for financing acquisition?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think we get a lot of questions from folks about, hey, I'm interested in buying other companies. I know it's going to be helpful to me in my growth plan. Overall growth strategy and the goals I have in my business, but I don't know where to start financing wise. Maybe I should go and try to raise some equity financing, sell some equity to raise some cash to do a deal. And a lot of folks that think about M&A early in their development or they're new to M&A think about that as the optimum strategy because they say, hey, then we're not carrying debt on the balance sheet. You know, we got another party that's participating, an investor class that's in participating in our growth, and it's lower risk than sort of debt. And I would argue that that's not really the case. I think that if you're a small tech-enabled services company, IT services company, that it's pretty hard to, one, go raise minority equity. It's challenging to do that. There are firms that do that, but I would just tell you it's challenging. The more important angle on that is that it's exceptionally expensive. It's actually the most expensive financing that you can get. And the reason that is because, as you can imagine, if you were to go at your current valuation and go sell, let's say, 30% of your equity and use that as an investment vehicle to go grow through acquisition, the overall value of the entire equity equation is going to go up once you do that acquisition and continue to go up as you grow the business over time. And that the cost of capital there, albeit lower risk because you're not carrying debt on your balance sheet, certainly will be very costly when it comes time for you to ultimately exit. The other thing that's important to note is that generally, most of these investors are going to look for a relatively quick turn on their money, meaning, you know, 5 years to 7 years. And by signing up for equity financing, you're going to be looking at your investors saying, hey, we kind of need our money out in 5 to 7 years. So you either need to do a recap or a sale in order to get those investors out. So it's not as low risk or no strings attached as you might imagine it to be on the surface. So that probably brings us to other financing approaches that make more sense. And so some of those certainly include, you know, as Ryan mentioned, cash on hand. You may have some cash on your balance sheet. Any way you look at it, if you're going to do an M&A deal, whether you're going to finance it or not, you're going to need some cash. Typically, if you're going to use traditional bank financing or SBA financing, you'll need a minimum of 20% of the purchase price available in cash on hand. And so I would just, you know, recommend anyone looking to do a deal that they fortify their balance sheet, have enough cash around to be able to fund at least 20% of what a loan might be. Now, loans either through the SBA 7A loan program or other SBA programs or traditional bank financing are actually pretty good ways to go for most tech services companies. There's pros and cons to different types of debt financing, which we can get into here in a bit. But for the most part, you can get a fairly long amortization schedule. You can pay predominantly all cash or mostly cash for a deal, which means you get some negotiating leverage with the seller when you're de-risking the deal. Pay a little less money for the deal if you do that. And, you know, it's pretty easy to model whether you can cash flow this business once you acquire it or not based on the amortization schedule. So we're pretty pro debt financing, particularly ones with reasonable kind of market-based interest rates. Certainly, there's a lot of debt financing that's not market-based interest rates. That's more risk-based. And we don't think those types of financing arrangements, you know, in the current environment that are getting to interest rates, you know, north of 10% would ever make sense for any buyer. But, you know, if you're bankable and you've got a good relationship with your bank, certainly most of them will loan you some money to go do deals. So I'll stop there for a second. Ryan, I don't know if you want to react to, you know, either the equity comments or the debt comments at this point.
Sure. Well, we'll start with the equity. So the opportunity of equity seems like it can give sellers a few options. So a seller could sell in and they could take and use some of that equity for future growth. So I think the opposite to it's harder, a bit harder to raise money. I think the opportunity for everyone to do better, rising tide floats all boats, helps with that equity option. So if there's if you're considering the equity route as a buyer, it certainly is expensive. You're going to give away more at the end than you are in the beginning. But if you're in for the long haul together, it's an option for growth that you may not be able to achieve through other means.
Yeah, and I guess the comment I would make there would be that you should know, let's look at, you know, minority equity versus majority equity investments. You'll find a lot more equity investors, including a lot of private equity investors, that will do a majority equity investment or recap. And those oftentimes can be a very good way to go to scale your business. And certainly there's been a lot of private equity money available to, you know, our listeners in the market, provided they have some scale. And I would define scale as, you know, firms that are, you know, pure play tech-enabled services firms, kind of north of 10 million bucks in revenue and probably, you know, starting to approach 2-3 million bucks in EBITDA. You know, there's lots of interesting private equity options that exist out there. You know, if you're a SaaS company, you know, you may be able to do it with a little less profit, but you need to certainly show a growth trajectory that would make a lot of sense and be attractive to private equity. And, you know, there's literally hundreds of private equity firms that are in our space and active in our space that want to either do add-on investments or build a business around a platform. And if you're a business that has consistent growing profits that, you know, are into kind of $2-3 million range in EBITDA, maybe even as low as $1.5 million in EBITDA and growing, you're probably in a position to have that conversation. Minority equity investors do exist, but they're much more rare. I would think kind of long and hard about that because certainly the governance structures that a minority investor will put into your business and require that you have in your business, as well as the milestones for growth, may in some ways be more arduous than that of a majority investor. And so, you know, it's a good business case for utilizing an advisor to help you if you're contemplating those kinds of things and looking at doing M&A transactions in general to make sure that you understand all the benefits, but as well all the risks associated with an equity investment to fuel your growth through acquisition.
Ryan, you brought up a point that I think is worth talking about, which is looking at things in the long haul, and not all cases are sellers thinking that way and or buyers thinking that way. But Mike, Ryan, how does time frame play into thinking about what the right financing option is?
You know, I would say you need to be thinking about being around and growing that business for at least another 5 years if you're contemplating an equity investment. I think equity is not a good solution for a short-term sort of view. And what I mean by that is, you know, almost everyone in our industry has built their firm or is building their firm to someday exit. And, you know, we've been doing this a long time and, you know, work with lots of clients. And I guess I haven't ever talked to one that has said to me that there wasn't probably an exit for them at some point on the horizon. You know, maybe they didn't know when or how, but, you know, they certainly thought, well, you know, the right deal comes along, or I reach a point in my life where I'm feeling like I want to retire, or maybe I've just, you know, want to move on and do something different, I'm going to exit this business. So I think having clarity about that timing in your own mind, if you're contemplating it, is pretty important if you're contemplating equity investments. Because as I mentioned before, you know, equity investors are not, they don't have an open-ended, hey, we're going to invest in this business. I don't want to say in all cases, but generally, they want to be able to see a return at some point. And that means that there's going to have to be a transaction or recap somewhere down the road. And they're going to want to be able to, frankly, have you exit that business. So you need to be thinking about that and be cognizant of that as you enter into a relationship with equity. And I guess I would argue that you should be thinking about that more broadly, regardless of what you're going to do in M&A, because part of the reason you're contemplating a merger or an acquisition from a growth perspective is because you're adding shareholder value. And at some point, you're going to want to harvest that.
Mike, is there anything that equity can do that cash or bank financing or a seller note can't do? Like some of the covenants for lending less, or what possibilities does equity bring that others might not?
Well, certainly equity brings the promise of being able to do much larger transactions. So, you know, we're fortunate in this country, sort of in North America and in our industry, that it attracts a lot of equity investors. And predominantly because a lot of these equity investors have done pretty well in tech over the years, and they want to stay in tech, or they grew up and exited a tech business and reinvested. And certainly there's lots of stories of family offices and private equity firms where people did really well, and then they reinvest their money back into tech, one as a way to give back, but also as a way to look for a broader return because they experienced it themselves. And so, you know, as you sort of think about that, it probably means that you can do much bigger transactions than you might have otherwise been able to do. You know, our general rule of thumb, if you're going to finance the deal yourself and put it together, whether it be through seller financing, debt financing, cash, sort of what we'll call carry back financing options or earnouts, you know, you're going to somewhat be limited in the size of the deal that you can probably do. And generally, you know, a deal about half your size is not atypical. You know, we recommend that's probably the right level of risk for someone who's going to use kind of more traditional financing vehicles minus equity. If you're going to do equity, you certainly can buy, you know, I don't want to say the sky's the limit, because it certainly will depend on your equity partner's appetite for deals. But generally, there's a much, much higher level of interest to do deals that are much larger, because their goal is to, you know, build a pretty material platform and ultimately exit to a large buyer at some point.
Great points. If we move it back over to the banking options then, Mike, maybe just start out with, I'd say, some benefits, but also what are some limitations that bank financing? We've done quite a few deals. We're working through one now that has some interesting, I would say, covenants. What are some things that a buyer should be aware of when they consider bank financing?
Well, I know that there's a lot of interest in SBA financing, and certainly there's quite a few limits to what SBA financing can do for you, and I'll jump right in there. You know, the best thing and best place to start sort of in traditional financing would be, you know, one, have a good relationship with your bank and go talk to them about options. They may be willing to just because you have a long-term relationship, finance your deal with traditional bank financing where the bank carries the paper, carries your loan. And that's a great place to start, typically if you have a good relationship with your bank, which I would encourage everyone to do. I think, you know, beyond that, even with a good relationship with your bank, oftentimes a bank might want to backstop the paper with an SBA loan. And part of the reason that is because the federal government guarantees that loan to the bank in the unlikely event that you would default on it. So depending on the loan and the loan program and the timing, they'll guarantee anywhere from up to 80% of that loan to the bank. And in some cases, in special circumstances, there was higher guarantee rate levels. And so those loans become, you know, pretty attractive for the bank because they can write loans that that their own loan committee may or may not be able to write or have comfort in carrying on their own balance sheet. You know, the challenge with SBA financing from a operator's perspective is that, you know, generally the SBA requires you to, in some cases, you know, the collateralization means that any of the assets that you own generally have to get pledged in support of that loan. We kind of call it the all-in provision. You have to be able to say, I will put the SBA as a second lien holder on all my assets. And not every operator wants that or cares to have that. But you need to know that that is generally the SBA's requirement, even if that loan is wildly over-collateralized. Now, they'll certainly do it if it's under-collateralized, which is a big benefit to using the SBA to do a deal. But I think, you know, what we tend to find with our customers over time is that as they accumulate wealth through operating their business or, you know, different businesses, or they get older, you know, oftentimes the size of transactions they're looking to do, they're actually going to over-collateralize the loan by pledging all of their assets. So, you know, that can be a sticking point for SBA financing that you should be aware about. Your bank, if they're going to write a loan for you outside of the SBA, may not require that. And a lot of it has to do with the relationship you have with the bank and, you know, maybe how much asset you have available. They may require to, you know, attach some assets, but not all of your assets. So those are subtleties that you need to kind of work out with your bank. But I certainly think that, you know, debt financing is a great way to go because you can have an amortization. It allows you to do a couple things. One, have an amortization that you can easily cash flow with the acquired business, which means that the profits on a month-to-month, quarter-to-quarter, and annual basis will be accretive to profitability even after debt service, which is kind of where you want to go, right? Because then that allows you to invest to grow the combined business in ways that you can't otherwise. And likewise, you know, it gives you an opportunity to probably be more aggressive in your negotiation with the seller, but because you're going to guarantee more, if not all, of the transaction value up front. And I think that anytime you can guarantee all the purchase price, whether it be for a loan from the bank, or maybe even what we sometimes refer to as carryback financing, or a loan from the seller, or a seller note, all those things are the same. You're able to sort of fix the purchase price. And anytime you can fix the purchase price and sort of guarantee it for the seller, it's good for them because they de-risk their deal. And it's good for you because you can, as a buyer, because you can typically negotiate a little lower price point.
Those are all great points, Mike. I'd like to go back to, and just to ask a question here on some of the issues with the bank loans. Can a seller roll some of their equity when bank loans, or specifically SBA loans, are in play?
Well, it's certainly a possibility. You know, it depends on the bank. And what I would tell you is that, you know, the type of bank you should work with in an SBA environment, and it depends on the SBA rules. So there's a few moving parts here. The SBA rules change fairly regularly, and we've seen them change over the years dramatically on what they're able to loan, how much they're able to loan, what program they're able to loan out of, for what kind of company. And the best types of banks to work with for SBA loans are those that are called an SBA preferred lender. An SBA preferred lender, you can find them actually on the bankrate.com. I think sometimes you can actually find them on NerdWallet as well, but I know that bankrate.com has a listing of SBA preferred lenders in your area. And the reason why you want to use SBA preferred lenders is because they make the lending decision. Okay, the SBA does not. And so they take it to their loan committee and they evaluate it, and they kind of manage and operate the rules of that loan pursuant to their own sort of banking rules. And if you're lucky enough to have had a long-term relationship with a bank that is also an SBA preferred lender, that's sort of the best of both worlds, right? And so I would certainly contemplate, if you're thinking about doing SBA loans in the future even, you might want to align your day-to-day banking relationship with one SBA preferred lender. We think ones that are sort of, you know, community banks, our experience has been, tend to be a little more nimble, a little easier to work with. Typically, those guys are range anywhere from about $250 million in assets to maybe, you know, $5 billion or so in assets, maybe a little more now in the current environment. As companies that, you know, will, you know, they focus on small business that are SBA preferred lenders are generally very, very good to work with on SBA loans. The challenge you run with banks that are not SBA preferred lenders is they have to send all the loan documents to a central SBA facility to make the loan decision. And these are people that don't know you, don't know the business you're trying to buy, or understand the imperative about what you're trying to do. And we think that makes it much, much more challenging to get an SBA finance deal, particularly in sort of IT services, tech-enabled services, or SaaS businesses. You're just going to be challenged to get a deal approved. Where if you get an SBA loan through a preferred lender, the likelihood it'll be approved, if it, you know, stands up to the scrutiny of valuation and deal structure that the SBA requires, is really high.
Good stuff. You had mentioned collateralization and that being all someone's assets. Can you help me understand what all means in that case? Are you talking just the business?
No. It means any real estate you might own. It may mean automobiles, boats, RVs, anything that the SBA could attach to make sure that you're going to pay that loan back. Now, I would tell you that the SBA is not in the business of repossessing all your assets so they can pay their loan back. Typically, if, you know, heaven forbid something happens and you can't pay the loan back, you know, the SBA has been known to work with lender, with the lender, but also with the debtor to figure out a payment structure so that they can get paid without having to repossess assets. But it is a sort of all-in program. And for most people who are small business owners seeking to get an SBA loan, they have to be prepared to step up for that.
Yeah, you're personally guaranteeing quite a bit in some of those cases.
Yep, and it includes all your business assets and generally all of your what could be liquid personal assets. Hey, you know, anything that would be in for example, a retirement account or a 401k, you know, can't be necessarily pledged to backstop these loans. There are a few exceptions. There's ways you can leverage 401ks to do M&A. So I don't want to get too far, you know, down that rabbit hole. But from just a collateralization perspective, you know, anything that's sort of in a retirement account or a brokerage account that's been sort of tax deferred is not eligible for collateralization.
You know, I think we've done a good job of sort of covering a bunch of options. So as a buyer, when do you disclose to a seller how you are financing a deal? Or, you know, and buyers have options. They go in with options, but typically they've got a preferred path in mind in terms of how they're going to finance a deal. You know, Mike, based upon your experience, Ryan, you too, I mean, when do you talk about it, right? When's the appropriate time?
Well, You know, I believe that transparency in M&A is super important. And I think coming into a transaction, you need to be very transparent about what your plan is in order to build confidence with a seller if you're a buyer. And, you know, sometimes it might flavor your offer. So, you know, what we haven't talked about much up to this point is, you know, how do you use a seller note or seller, it's often called seller carryback financing, as part of the consideration in a deal. And that goes hand in hand with an earnout, right? So up to a few years ago, you know, most deals had about at least 60% guaranteed consideration or cash, and the rest was something else, right? Either a combination of an earnout or maybe a carryback note. And, you know, I'd say in more recent times and years, there's been a lot more that's been more cash or guaranteed. You know, as much as some studies say as high as 86% of deals in recent years have been that way. But there's no right or wrong way to finance these deals. But I think to your point, Matt, what's important is to be transparent about what your plan is to fund the deal right up front and let the seller know where you're at, because certainly your inability to get a transaction done, you know, isn't good for anybody. And so you had to have done your homework as a buyer and talking to your bank ahead of time. Sometimes the challenges with that are that you can't really initiate bank financing until you have a signed letter of intent. So you have to, you know, talk to your bank and understand what's possible and make sure they have input on deal structure. And if they're leaning in based on the financial condition of your business and the transaction and the financials for the business that you're evaluating, then you can pretty confidently structure the LOI and talk to your seller about how you plan to fund it. And if they're in alignment with that and they agree to the terms of the LOI, then you can initiate your, you know, financing approach. The only exception to that would probably be, you know, equity financing. It's hard to enter into a transaction if you haven't already aligned around equity financing and you have that capital available, because typically that is a more challenging exercise. And you kind of have to have that capital partner by your side and already signed up so that you can go to that seller and talk to them about structuring based on how that equity partner would be comfortable. But to answer your question much more directly, Matt, I would say you want to be very upfront about the reality of how you plan to pay and maybe even some of the challenges you may be facing yet, so that everybody can go in eyes wide open.
Transparency is key in financing and everything else, right? As we've talked about a number of times.
The one thing I've noticed here, Matt, and I think it's a great question, is that if a buyer plans to obtain a large amount of debt financing, the seller wants to ensure that the operations of the business are still taken care of and then growth can still succeed, especially if there's any kind of earnout involved. So if you find a deal that is, it's a great deal, you both work well together, but you leverage it to the point where you have such a big debt service, sellers can be a little scared off on that. So we see that quite a bit.
And I think it's part of why we say, you know, a 50% of your size, right? You know, because the seller needs to be comfortable. They're going to do reciprocal diligence on you as a buyer and make sure that you can actually fund this thing. Right. Either their representative or their partner advisor is going to do that work, or you're going to do that work. And you're going to want to make sure that they're solvent, that the business has access to that capital, that you've, you know, done a screen share, looked at accounts. If they say they have cash available, if they really have it, you can't take their word for it, because you might get down this rabbit hole of diligence and they can't raise the money or can't find the money, or their bank financing falls out of bed. You have to make sure they're solvent. And beyond that, you know, when they're carrying that debt service, that they can service it in a meaningful way. And that has a lot more to do with sort of the combined financial picture as well. Now, what you should know is that a traditional bank isn't going to enter into an arrangement with a borrower where they have a high probability of getting in trouble. Because the bank's on the hook for that money and they're at risk too. So, you need to know that. But it does require that you're going to have to do some diligence and be smart about how much risk is that buyer taking on to do your transaction? And is that something you're comfortable with, particularly if there's some amount of money that's in an earnout to you or some sort of seller note that requires that that business stay healthy for a while?
That's a great point. I've got one last question here, and Matt, feel free to ask anything as well. But if someone has enough cash on hand to finance a deal, should they just use that, or is it you're better off considering multiple options?
Well, it depends a lot on the buyer, right? You know, the cheapest way to buy a business is all cash, right? Any way you look at it. You have the most leverage. You don't have a carrying cost associated with a loan, whether that be from the seller or a bank, which you got to pay interest, right, on loans. Whenever you get a loan, you're paying interest. And if you have it available and it's not, you know, gutting your balance sheet to, you know, into your rainy day fund to the point where you'd be nervous running your business at that level, then, yeah, the most cost-effective way to buy your business is for all cash, particularly if you believe in the transaction. And I would tell you that, you know, if you don't believe in the transaction, regardless of how you finance it, you shouldn't do it, right? So, you know, you oftentimes find firms that are very diligent about how they look at their internal rate of return, their sort of return on investment, return on capital. You know, that's what advisors like Revenue Rocket do. We help you figure that out. And then they use the leverage, you know, cash is king, right? They use that leverage to negotiate an aggressive transaction. They pay for it and move into, you know, combining the business. It does make the transaction much less complicated on a variety of fronts. It does make integrating the business much easier. It's just all kinds of things that makes a lot easier for you as a buyer to be able to facilitate. Now, there's things that are kind of a close second. For example, buying a firm with a seller note or carryback financing is also a way to guarantee the purchase price. You will have to pay interest on the portion that's the note from the seller. But in the eyes of the seller, typically, that as long as they have comfort with your solvency from a financial perspective and the likelihood of that to continue, they generally be open to that because it's guaranteed, right? And they're a secured debtor, you know, with your business. So the likelihood they're going to get paid if you're, you know, operate a strong business is high, and they'll do that. And that's a great way also to get a good return. If you begin to get into an earnout, which a lot of people as buyers say, yeah, we really like earnouts. Earnouts tend to benefit sellers more than buyers, particularly because, you know, if you believe in the transaction and the combination comes together and you guys go crush it together. And, you know, one of the premises we often talk about in M&A is that if you can get to a place together that you can't get apart, that's certainly a strong strategic imperative to do a deal. And if that place means you're going to quickly grow revenue and profit, an earnout is certainly going to benefit the seller in a very meaningful way. And that's great. Now, so there's trade-offs to the buyer. It means you'll pay more, right? You'll pay more for that transaction. You need to know that going in. And it's likely that you will pay more using an earnout. But the trade-off is to that is you'll typically de-risk that transaction should, for whatever reason, the deal underperform in the future versus your estimates. And so there is a benefit to you. But I would just say that most of the time, you know, and most of the studies we've seen are sort of mid-80s percent, 85, 86% of the time, earnouts get paid out at or above sort of their intended value. And so you should understand as a buyer how you're using that and be able to be open to the likelihood you may overpay.
You know, we, a couple of podcasts ago, talked about readiness. This is an important piece to readiness. And here we are. We're moving into 2023. I think we all anticipate just a continued, very active marketplace. I think that more and more firms in tech overall, tech-enabled services in particular, are recognizing that inorganic growth is absolutely critical, not to be just in the top quartile, but just to be competitive. And so I think great discussion, guys. Lots of options. Readiness is super important, and we're here. As a matter of fact, we've got an unbelievable and growing readiness program. So great discussion.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, I think so. You know, we're here to help. A message I guess I'd send to everybody who's listening is that, you know, even if you're contemplating maybe doing some deals in the future and you don't know if you're ready or you think that it's going to take you a while to get ready, we certainly have a active strategy practice that works with companies that are working to be ready to do a deal, whether they're going to buy or sell years out, and they want to be prepared. And certainly we can help you with that, as we've helped many companies over the years do that. I would also just add, sort of in closing, that, you know, we oftentimes get asked questions, you know, do we see in 2023 the market, you know, going down or cratering or valuations being impacted and, you know, all this stuff. And I would tell you that in this sort of world of IT services, tech-enabled services, we don't see that. We don't see a situation where things are going down. I think it has a lot to do with sort of a perfect storm of limited, you know, technical talent and solutions that companies need to fend off inflation and fend off being more efficient with fewer employees and all that stuff. So, you know, certainly we don't see a lower demand for M&A or even lower valuation multiples, at least in the sectors that we operate in. And so I would encourage all of you to, you know, keep a steady hand on the tiller and keep running your businesses and growing your businesses like you have, and certainly contemplate the strategic imperative of buying other firms to continue to expand your footprint. And when the time's right, you know that if you're going to exit, that it's a very, very healthy market. And I think you don't have to worry about trying to time the market as much as certainly some sellers are contemplating right now. Any thoughts, Ryan, before we tie it up?
I think you nailed it all. I'll pass it back to you. Thanks for a lot of great insight and thoughts on this topic. So back to you, Mike.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. With that, we'll tie a ribbon on it for this week's Shoot the Moon podcast. I encourage you guys to tune in to all 100-plus episodes of our Shoot the Moon podcast on your favorite outlets for podcasts. I encourage you to tune in next week. Thanks a lot, and make it a great week.